If you begin to deconstruct 21st century HR into its core components, one of them will definitely be people analytics. The ability to kind of distill and analyze and synthesize all of the different disparate data sources we have around our people and extract actionable insights from them is really one of the key components that separates best-in-class HR teams from their more traditional peers. And in this episode of the 21st Century HR Podcast, I'm going to be joined by one of who I view as the leaders in this space, David Green out of the UK. We've recently collaborated on a Fast Company article exploring people analytics, and this podcast is going to be a deeper dive into some of the points we hit in that article. We're going to talk about how companies are getting it right when it comes to people analytics, what are some case studies and examples, and where do you get started? So one of the things that I'm always keen to learn is for organizations that have firmly established functions, they have a cadence and a rhythm that they usually use, and it's in motion. But for those of you that are new to people analytics, that journey can be a little scary. It can be a little intimidating. And so David walks us through some tips on how and where to get started if you're new to people analytics. So really excited to explore that with him as soon as we get back from a quick word from our sponsor. 21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey everyone, welcome to 21st Century HR Podcast. I am thrilled today to be joined by a friend of mine, David Green, and we're going to have a bit of a nerd out on a recent Fast Company article that we co-contributed to on people analytics. We are here live together, actually, at the Aria Casino in Las Vegas for the Unleash Conference. And David, why don't you give the listeners just a quick intro and a bit of background on you before we get started?
Well, firstly, Lars, thanks for having me on the show. Hi everyone, so my name's David Green. I'm an executive director at Insight 222, which is a firm that supports people analytics leaders have more impact within their organizations. And we do that for a mix of networking, a bit of co-creation on topics of common interest to members, learning, so we've developed an online academy at myhrfuture.com, and then also consulting as well. And over the last 6 or so years, I've been in the people analytics space, initially curating and creating articles, and latterly speaking at conferences. So like Lars, I'll be speaking at the Unleash conference over the next 2 days.
Yeah, so David, I was really excited when I started thinking about the concept for this story. You were frankly the first and only person that came to mind that I wanted to write it with, because you've been somebody on the people analytics side that I think has been a great kind of source of content, but most importantly also kind of the evolution of the field and where it's heading. So, you know, you going back 6 years, you were one of the early people kind of driving this new trend towards people analytics. What drew you to the field so early on?
Well, firstly, that's very kind of you. So, I think sometimes you can have an accident in the timing. I mean, what drew me to the field, I've been in the HR space pretty much since 1997, principally in talent acquisition. But I had a five-year sojourn in France. So we moved over to France, you know, I got married there, had the kids, and actually worked in a different industry, worked in the technology industry, and got into data from there, really, because we started, the company I was working for, we started providing insights to our customers around their data, and the data was basically traveler data, so passengers on airlines or customers of travel agencies. So we first of all started providing insights around that data that supported them making better business decisions. Then we started creating products out of that data as well. And I remember thinking, why didn't we do more of this, you know, in the recruiting space? We've got so much data, yet most of the decisions we make about who we hire is still a lot based on gut and not really much on science.
Yeah.
So when I came back to the UK in 2011, I resolved to find out actually was anything happening in this space. And you know, and it didn't take long to find out that companies like Google clearly had been kind of pioneering people analytics, or certainly popularizing people analytics through the work Laszlo Bott and Prasad Sethi were doing it at there. But there were others, and actually, when you look into it, people analytics has actually been going on, albeit under different names, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So I kind of got it from there, curiosity, and it piqued my curiosity. And once I kind of opened the box, that was it. I was smitten, as it were. And initially, just started. For my own interest, really, and my own learning, this reading as much as possible, then started kind of summarizing some of those articles and putting on the LinkedIn, and that seemed to get quite a good response. So then started creating, I think it was at the time, only annual summaries of some of the articles that had helped me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was working in what was the RPO space at the time, really trying to work with our product team around how we could actually provide more insights to our customers around the data that we were collecting around, you know, the people that we were hiring for them. So yeah. That's kind of where it started. But I also should give a shout out to people like Josh Burson, of course,
yeah.
But principally more people like Andrew Merritt and Luke Schmeyers and Jeremy Shapiro, who certainly helped me when I was getting started, A, providing great content, but B, being very open to collaborate and, you know, and talk, basically, so.
Yeah, and it's interesting kind of hearing that path that took you towards people analytics. I mean, when you look at the field, if you've been following the field, even for the last 4 years, you can see that we're very much hitting a kind of evolutionary cycle of the function that is certainly front of mind for most talent leaders. And whether you look at data from LinkedIn or a variety of other sources, they all show people analytics is one of the most in-demand skill sets to build within the HR function. I mean, where do you see the field as people analytics in its kind of evolutionary cycle right now?
Well, certainly if I see where it was 6 years ago when I kind of started getting into it,
yeah.
it's been transformed, as you say. I mean, it was almost like something on the periphery of HR, you know, which some companies were doing, but it was mostly on the periphery. And now I see it being very central to HR strategy moving forward. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think A, people see the good work that the pioneers have been doing in this space. But I think, you know, we're producing more data anyway, you know, both as consumers and as employees and as organizations. And, you know, I think we're living in time, interesting time, should we say, politically, economically, socially. A lot of disruption going on within organizations. And really, if an organization is grow and survive, then they really need to understand, you know, it's people that's going to help them to do that. And ultimately, it's then understanding the data around the people that can help them make better decisions.
Yeah.
And then you look at it from an employee perspective as well. You know, you think about ourselves as consumers. You know, we're able to, you know, if we go onto Netflix, we go onto Amazon, everything's personalized for us and it's based on our previous, you know, search habits or buying habits. And, you know, we want that sort of stuff at work as well. We want personalized recommendations around training, around onboarding. Again, if you're searching for a job, you know, if you can actually have recommendations around jobs that you might be suitable for based on your skills, your geographical location and or preferences, etc. That's the kind of stuff that's really helpful to people. So, and interestingly, you say, you know, so if you look at some of the stats out there, and we refer to some of them in the article,
yeah.
So the Corporate Research Forum, they did a study, it's about 18 months old now, but they found that 69% of large organizations now have a people analytics team. And a large organization they defined as being over 10,000 people. I still think some of those teams are probably reporting teams that have been rebranded, but it does show the ambition is there.
Yep.
Then you look at the stuff that LinkedIn brought out last year. They did some regional reports, I think, around North America, EMEA, and APAC. If we just look at the North America one, they saw that the number of people on LinkedIn who had people analytics or HR analytics as a skill had trebled in a five-year space from 2014 to 2018. And actually, you know, one of the businesses that I'm working with at My HR Future, we just done some research. We actually asked HR practitioners, you know, what's the skill you most want to learn in 2019, and people analytics came out on top.
Yeah.
So I think there's, you know, there's more companies doing it. There's more people in the space, and there's still demand from HR professionals to learn about the space.
Yeah, we found similar demand in the HR Open Source Future of Work report last year as well, where I think that was one of the most important future. We kind of defined future of work as 3 years. out. We put a 3-year horizon on it. And that was the one, the most kind of transformative component to a talent strategy that respondents felt would actually help transform, you know, their businesses in the future and how they go about kind of, you know, building both their HR strategy, but really providing value to the organization. And I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, you've worked with a lot of different companies at a lot of different stages of implementation and success. For those that have yet to kind of build a people analytics function, and maybe it's an HR director somewhere who's trying to advocate for it internally, how can they best make the case for their company to invest in people analytics? Where should they get started?
Well, first thing, it's never too late. You know, certainly not too late with this. And, you know, there's still many organizations that are already in the early stages of getting started. So grasp the nettle by the horns and get on with it, I think it's probably the message. I think the most important thing is to really think about what are the business challenges that your organization faces, and then think about the people elements of those business challenges and how data and analytics could potentially help you get insights that could actually mean that you can either solve that challenge or be successful with that business strategy. So think cross-functionally, is what I would say. So this is not something that you can do in isolation in HR. If you're going to solve a business challenge, you need to bring HR data and combine it with business data, maybe some external data as well, maybe you can create some new data via survey or other means. So I think that's the first thing. There will be some people perhaps in HR who have some of the skills that can get you started. Maybe find some HR business partners that are analytically minded and curious enough that will help you get the right attention of the right people in the business, so you can start talking to them about things that you could potentially do. Having a CHRO or senior HR leader on site, I think, is very helpful. It doesn't always have to be the CHRO, but I think the CHRO has certainly got to be supportive and invest in, be prepared to invest in this, because it doesn't happen from nowhere. But, you know, reach out to other analytics professionals in the business, finance, marketing. There's plenty you can learn from. You know, one of the advantages of being the last mover, as HR really is in this space, is that there are other experts in the business that can support you to do that. And there's a great example on the HR open source site from Virgin Media around, I think it was a hypothesis that the recruiting team had, that the candidate experience was so bad that it was actually costing them customers.
Yeah.
And actually, when they took that hypothesis to the customer analytics team, they were prepared to investigate it, and they found out, yes, that was true. And they then got the investment to actually improve the candidate process. So I think it's things like that. It's really thinking, you know, about big business challenges. You know, how does a company make money? How can we grow? How can we save money? You know, that sort of stuff, I think, is the important thing to be thinking about, rather than how can I determine the ROI of the training budget, for example.
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point around kind of prioritizing around pain points, right? Because I think too often in HR, when we're looking to build something, especially a topic like this, that clearly it's front of mind, it's in the industry press everywhere. If you're not doing this, you're going to start to feel very inferior within your organization, because you're seeing that everybody around you is starting to invest more in this. But if you don't have a targeted strategy to build the case internally around, like, what are real pain points that the business has, and how can I make a case based on that so that it feels real to the leaders and people who ultimately have to approve, you know, writing a check or making the investment. I think that's a really great point, because otherwise, you know, saying that you need to do it because everybody's doing it, it's not a great business case.
No.
For investment in particular. So when you think about companies, so you talk about kind of that being the right path. What's the wrong path? What mistakes are you seeing companies make when they're building out a people analytics function, strategy? What are the landmines people need to look out for?
I think there are several, so we'll just try and cover a few of them, I think. I think the main thing is where people start with the data and not with a business problem. So the opposite of what we've just been talking about, really. You know, if you give data to a bunch of analysts, they'll find something, but they might not find something particularly interesting or particularly important to the business. So a great example there, you know, I was in India a couple of years ago. I was meeting with the chief analytics officer of a very, very large company out there. He had a very supportive CEO. And he and the team had done some great work in other areas of analytics, not in HR. Thought that it was about time they did something in HR. Looked at externally to see what other companies had done. It had been a lot of stuff around attrition. So they thought, okay, well, we'll develop a flight risk model. So they spent 6 months developing it. They tested it. they told me it was over 90% accurate. And then they went to HR and the business, and no one cared because their attrition rate as a business was so low. So it wasn't a problem. So great work, but wrong problem.
Right.
So I think that's probably the main challenge. I think there's others that people obsess about getting their data completely accurate. We've got to have 100% accurate data. You know, you're never going to have 100% accurate data. Ask finance. They never have 100% accurate data. You know, you've got to be prepared to back your data and be prepared to be challenged on it. But then working with finance to test your, to validate your numbers, certainly when you're getting started out, is probably a good bit of advice. I think the other stuff is just not getting the basic foundations in place as well. So, you know, not thinking around things around data security, data standards, data stewardship, not really having a clear process around ethics. I think that's a big thing. And then not having, you know, not prioritizing. So again, go back to the business challenge thing. You know, once you start doing this, you'll get quite a lot of requests from the business. A lot of those requests are for pieces of data. You know, you've got to be quite strong and resist, you know, just giving people data. Okay, why do you want the data? What's the problem you're trying to solve? And then start to prioritize. I know at IBM, we didn't work on a project in their people analytics function unless there was at least a $50 million return to the business. Now you can do that once you've got a large team, but you know, and you've created a track record of success, but you know, be mindful of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously data privacy and data laws are certainly you know, front of mind for a lot of people in this space right now. And I think a great reinforcing your point, I remember when we did a case study in HR Open Source from SoundCloud, and it was about them building a people analytics dashboard. And they spent a year building it and didn't loop in legal to make sure it was compliant until the very end, and ended up having to scrap the entire thing and rebuild it from the ground up because it wasn't compliant. And that was a very painful lesson, but I think a great reminder that that's something you really have to make sure is kind of embedded in your journey early on, just to make sure that you're not building something that gets you out of compliance and then you end up having to scrap things that you built at a later stage.
Well, I think ethics is the biggest risk for people analytics, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, we've seen scandals outside in the consumer analytics space. Won't mention the companies necessarily, but you know, that's not been good publicity for them. And actually, according to research that Accenture did this year, it's actually made employees more nervous about how their organizations are handling their data, even though this isn't, you know, organizations mishandling employee data. This is companies mishandling consumer data. And we've certainly done a lot of work on that at Insight 222. It was a big challenge for our members, and we actually helped create an ethics charter co-created with them, which then they can then take and iterate within their own organizations. And a couple of examples, Microsoft, who have been doing this for a long time, you know, check out some of the stuff that Dawn Klinghoffer writes and shares around some of the work that they're doing there. But they have a privacy expert on their people analytics team, you know, who actually gets involved in the work from the outset and all the way through. And similarly, ABN AMRO, the Dutch bank, you know, when they were starting out, you know, every time they want to do a project, they go to legal and make sure that they can do it. And then every time before they communicate any of the results, exactly the same thing, they go to legal and make sure that they can communicate the results and get advice on how they can communicate them. My advice would be to transparent, you know, involve employees and the workforce in this, not just workers' councils in some of the European countries, but actually involve employees, be transparent about what you're doing. And if employees think it's creepy, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point too. When you talk, I mean, even the example you gave in India where being able to predict turnover based on employee behavior. You know, I was reading an article actually the flight over, and it was about, you know, talking about the challenge of, you know, having systems and tools now that can basically determine things like flight risk based on digital footprint and social media usage and the ethical questions of that. So saying, you know, the one argument is, okay, if there's content that employees are putting out in the public domain, it's ready for public consumption. And the counter to that was, okay, well, you could hire a detective to follow around a potential hire and see what their behavior is, but is that really ethical? Is that really? And so I think that's something that we will have to continue to you know, evaluate and kind of consider. I think even more so as you're starting to see the growth of these kind of teams and these kind of technologies allow us to do things and really understand behaviors in ways we haven't been able to before.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think flight risk models can be good. I think clearly there's a benefit to the organization if you can take action and take interventions to stop some of your best people leaving.
Yeah.
And I think there's a potential benefit there for employees as well, because ultimately they still have free choice on whether they leave or not. You know, but certainly if you can get out of cycle pay increases, I've seen companies like Facebook offering bonuses for people to move closer to the Facebook office because they found out that actually commute distance was a predictor of someone being more likely to leave in certain job roles. But you have to be careful because you don't want to get in a situation where, certainly in a recruiting space, where you're actually ruling people out because they've got a longer commute distance, because potentially that's because they live in more deprived areas.
Right.
And that's bias. So you've got to be very careful around it. And I think just testing the models and, you know, and maybe a good way of looking at it is, you know, if this got into the New York Times, would we be okay with it?
Yeah.
And if you would, and you've been communicated with employees what you're doing, then fine, you know. But if not, maybe you shouldn't do it.
Yeah. And what I'm curious, what are your favorite examples of a success story with People Analytics?
Well, there are a lot out there.
Yeah.
And I love some of the stuff that I'm seeing doing, which is actually helping improve employee experience and well-being. And there's a lot of work that companies are doing around improving diversity and culture as well. But if I had to pick one, I'll pick one that's quite simple, and it's in the article actually. So it's from Nielsen. And why I've picked it is because it's a great example of focusing on the right business problem, getting a senior level sponsor within your organization, actually getting some insights, and then putting HR programs in place to deliver business outcomes and supporting, you know, employees as well. So this is going back to 2015. So new head of People Analytics came in, and actually he had previously run the business for Nielsen in India. So he was a business person coming into HR, but was passionate around how, you know, improving employees' lives and using data to help to do that. And the first thing he did was he interviewed a lot of the senior business leaders within Nielsen around certain business challenges they were having. And he spoke to a lady who was leading, I think, the consumer business in the US. And she said, I think I've got a problem with attrition, and I think it's costing us money because a lot of my people are on site with customers. So the People Analytics leader thought, that's an interesting thing to investigate, and certainly we can do that. So he then thought, okay, what are the questions that I could answer for this business leader that would help her and her team? And the first thing was, okay, why are people leaving? And is there anything we can do about it? That's the first two. And then the other one is, what's the cost? What's the cost of the business? And they were able to ascertain quite quickly that in this particular business unit, 1%, you know, increase in attrition was worth $5 million. So he now had the attention of this business leader to find out, okay, well, why were people leaving and what can we do about it? The next thing he did again was really work with the business and surveyed them really and interviewed them to understand what were the hypotheses that surround people might be leaving, because then you can test that using the data. And there was one hypothesis that female and more diverse employees had a high propensity to leave in this business unit. And they had another one around people that work remotely, i.e. on the customer site or work remotely from home, and again had a high propensity to leave. They found with the data that actually men were just as likely to leave as females in this particular business unit. But they did find a correlation with, you know, if you weren't working on a Nielsen site. But they found something else that they hadn't expected. And that's a great thing about analytics, because you can either prove or disprove things, and you can find things you didn't expect.
Yeah.
And what they found was that if you'd been in the same role for more than 3 years, you had a 48% more chance of leaving than someone had been in that role for less than 3 years, which is quite staggering.
Yeah.
So their problem was actually around mobility. And they had HR programs in place for this. They had a program called Ready to Rotate, but it hadn't been communicated particularly well. And it wasn't being promoted particularly well as well. So they took two big steps from an HR program perspective. Firstly, built into all talent reviews with the CEO, they actually wanted to understand mobility. And secondly, they re-promoted this Ready to Rotate program to employees to tell them about the opportunities that they had in Nielsen. And they made it easy for them to apply and stick their hand up if they felt it was time for a change. A lateral move, we're not talking necessarily about promotion. And they ran it for 6 months, and there's a great video on YouTube actually, which gives some of the findings. But they found in 6 months that they significantly reduced attrition, and then over a year they reduced it by 3 percentage points, $15 million. And what they did is they communicated it really, really well, because this was actually helping him. It was helping the business, but it was helping employees as well.
Sure.
Find career opportunities within a company they didn't necessarily want to leave. And what they did as well, because they communicated it so well, they created momentum around people analytics, because they created video, a really not easy video to anyone can see. Again, it's on YouTube. And they had other business units and other countries in Nielsen coming to the people analytics team saying, we want to do something like this as well. So that's what I like about it. There's a clear business return, really good methodology around getting that sponsor, identifying the right problem, providing the insight, and then putting the programs in place to actually deliver the outcomes. So, and great communication as well, and storytelling.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting as you kind of describe it that way, and I think it makes a lot of sense that if you are... The opportunity to have a transformational impact on the business is very clear. And so as you're beginning to establish the function, they can get some visible, quick, and very kind of bottom line driven results, which will then make them more in demand, which goes back to your earlier point around saying you have to kind of be judicious with the projects that you undertake, because I think most leaders, when they see that kind of an impact, they're going to say, great, we want to, you know, put that lens on our business and see where we can drive more efficiencies and identify processes that need to be tweaked. And if you get that appetite throughout the business, you can quickly be spread too thin, and then your level of impact diminishes as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, for you, you know, you've been somebody who's been kind of aggregating and distilling the best of kind of people analytics content for years. What are your sources? Who inspires you? How do you find the case studies, the articles, the research that inform your worldview around people analytics, but also inspire you to keep kind of your curiosity honed to learn more?
Well, I suppose the reason why I initially started doing it was to learn myself.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to put something out there, then you've got to understand what you're reading and create a summary that is helpful for people. And it's hard work, I'll be honest with you, but people, I've had so many practitioners come up to me, you know, whether they're people analytics leaders or people interested in getting into the space, that it's really helpful, which has kind of spurred me to carry on doing it. It's almost like giving back, I guess, to the community.
Sure.
In terms of sources, I'm quite lucky. People now send me articles. You've got the standard things like Mitslow Management Review, HBR, you know, people like Josh Burson. You know, I know quite a lot of people analytics leaders now, and even though they may only produce one or two articles a year, they're always really good. So you just get to learn the resources. And what I've tried to do over the last year, or certainly 18 months, is show how people analytics has broadened out. So I've started to categorize some of the articles that I select now. So there's lots of way that data is really fueling, you know, driving data in diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. It's certainly helping support employee experience. It's definitely supporting stuff around skills for the future and future of work. So what I'm trying to do is show a cross-section, some definitely examples from people analytics practitioners themselves, or from people that actually work in the space, because I think that's important, as well as some of the thought leaders around it as well. But I think the good thing is there is a lot out there.
Yeah.
Now that can be a challenge as well.
Yeah.
But you know, people will say to me, you know, either that, you know, they'll say, oh, you should read this article, it's really good. So that kind of helps. And I've kind of got into a regular cadence of bookmarking stuff, summarizing stuff. If I read something I think it's really good, I'll summarize it straight away. And so I'm not sitting down at the end of every month, I'd be told, oh my God, I've got to find 15 articles. It's good, and it does show how the space has broadened out. Because when I started doing this, I think I had 20 for a year. Now there were more articles, of course, and that now, yeah, every month I'm struggling to get it down to 10, and I'm not very good at doing that, so I end up with 15. There's a lot to choose from, and it really helps my learning. So, you know, that's why I carry on doing it really as much as anything else.
Well, I mean, one thing I'm curious about as well, so you, and from early on, for at least the last couple of years, you've been primarily leveraging LinkedIn to kind of develop your digest, your kind of summary and including it there, and it gets incredible engagement. And I'm just curious, what made you choose LinkedIn over a blog or other, you know, destinations where you could be housing the data? Because the level of engagement is pretty fantastic. So you can tell that you've built an audience there, and there's a real appetite for the content. But what led you to LinkedIn for that?
It's probably initial laziness, yeah, to be honest, because I didn't have to create my own blog and maintain it. And I think LinkedIn reached out I wasn't one of the earliest to be able to use a publisher platform, but certainly was in, you know, they offered me the opportunity to do it. I thought, this is really easy, isn't it? And it has helped me build a following on LinkedIn, you know, and it certainly wasn't deliberate. You know, that's sometimes the best things happen by accident.
Yeah.
This is kind of an example of that. So I use Twitter as well, which I find quite useful. And now I can schedule stuff. I've actually got round to being able to use Hootsuite. I don't know why it took me so long. But LinkedIn, I think, is a great platform. You know, I'm a big fan of LinkedIn. I know it has its critics, but I think on the whole, I think it's, you know, okay, some of the content on there is maybe not that good. But hey, who am I to decide what's good and what isn't? You know, I see some people put stuff out there which I think, well, that's not that good, but then it's got really good engagement. So
yeah,
you know,
it's a bit hard to determine what content is going to resonate on LinkedIn, because you're right. I mean, some of it I'll read and I was like, okay, this is fantastic, and engagement will be low. And the other thing is, I'm like, I don't understand why this is even here, and engagement is through the roof. So I think it's really hard to predict. I don't think there's a code to crack necessarily on what content is going to best resonate on LinkedIn.
I don't think. They used to have that pulse, didn't they? And yeah, sometimes some of your articles will be featured on that, and then you get a huge surge.
Then you get a big boost, yeah.
But that seemed, they didn't seem to have that anymore. I put a lot of my content now on My HR Future, because that's a site that's specifically aimed at people analytics, strategic workforce planning, and the future of work. So that kind of makes sense.
Yep.
That's obviously, and it's also part of the company I work for. But LinkedIn is still really good. I mean, I find it really good. But less so sometimes with putting an article on there, but actually just putting a post with a link to something, you know, you can get some really good engagement. So
yeah,
taught me marketing anyway.
All right, well, speaking of social media, what is the best way for listeners to connect with you after the show?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn, David Green. Yes, I know it's a common name, but yeah, I'm the one with quite a big quiff on there. And in Twitter, I'm at David_Green_UK. And then you can read my articles on myhrfuture.com, or one word.
Great. Well, David, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your wisdom. And we will be reading.
Thank you, Lars. It's been great to speak to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.